the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. During the heyday of The Carpenters in the early 1970s, it was something of a sin to admit to liking them. It was like endorsing Richard Nixon. Rock critics shunned them. They were labeled saccharine, syrupy, and sickly sweet. Although no one admitted to liking them, they sold millions of records, even a couple to me. History, however, has been kind to them, and today their artistry is recognized as among the best recording acts of their era. A fuller appreciation of their work and talent was due, and my guest, Randy Schmidt, has accomplished that with his new book, Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. Randy Schmidt, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, it's great to be visiting with you. Thank you.
The story of Karen Carpenter, it's almost unbearably sad. It just keeps getting sadder as your book takes us to her untimely and needless death. She died in 1983 at the age of 32. It really seems like a case of slow suicide. I mean, a 32-year-old woman with a successful career and millions of dollars and many friends starves to death in Downey, California. And I guess the question of why, you know, just looms over the story of her accomplishments as an entertainer. Do you have any idea why it happened?
I think there are so many factors, and the one thing that, by bringing a lot of them into light, and some for the first time ever with this book, the thing that I didn't want to do was say, let's all point a lot of fingers and lay the blame on these people or these situations, because at this point, this many years after her death, that won't do anybody any good. But I do think that there are a lot of factors that played into that, beginning from some of the earliest points of life with issues, and then, of course, as fame began to take hold, she was still quite young. She was 16 when she got her first recording contract, and 19 whenever they then signed with A&M Records. And first number one at age 20. So a lot of pressures of fame as well came into that.
Well, you know, in terms of pointing blame, I mean, wouldn't Karen Carpenter be the one most responsible for not eating?
I didn't realize until I had spoken with Frenda Franklin, who was Karen's best friend for quite a few years, that it really wasn't about food. And the afternoon that I spent there with Frenda was eye-opening in a lot of ways. And when I say it's not about food, when it really kind of sank in and clicked for me is when she explained that Karen had a hole in her heart. And the way she explained it was that it wasn't something that could be filled by, you know, the love of friends. And they said that they tried to love her extra to fill that gap. It wasn't something that could be filled by fame and fortune. It couldn't be filled by the love of a man, even though she wanted so desperately to have a loving marriage. And she said it was the hole where the love of a mother should have been, and that she feels that it was that manifested itself in the form of anorexia, and that food and appearance were really the furthest thing from Karen's mind at that time, especially later on in life.
Well, I guess to some extent Karen Carpenter is to anorexia nervosa as Rock Hudson was to AIDS, and that she was the first major celebrity to die from a disease that very few people really understood the seriousness of.
Yes, she was the first celebrity definitely to bring that into the forefront, and unfortunately it wasn't just the awareness, but it was the awareness that it can kill. And she has kind of been that proverbial poster child for a long time since then. And hopefully people are able to not only learn from that, but also see the talent that was there as well, because there are both sides to her story. There's the amazing talent and the fantastic legacy that she's left us. And then there is that warning and those lessons that we can learn from her life as well.
Well, you mentioned her mother, and I guess her relationships with her family, particularly with her mother and absolutely with her brother and partner, Richard, were not exactly healthy relationships.
Her mother, really from the time Karen was a little girl, her mother it seems like maybe coached her in this family philosophy that we are all here to support Richard. Richard is going to be a superstar one way or another, and it's our goal, and we were put here to support that. And so anything that she did, whether it be musical or otherwise, if it was, you know, she played the drums, well, great, she could play backup for Richard's piano. Or, oh, now she sings, well, she can sing along with Richard. And that was tough because she really never got the recognition within her own family for her talents.
She was just the backup singer for Richard.
Exactly. And people who knew them well into the mid-70s and throughout the high parts of their career would say that, you know, Agnes still thought of Richard as the star of the duo and would complain, you know, that he wasn't getting enough FaceTime on television and that sort of thing.
What about her father? I mean, in your book, he's kind of an absentee father. I mean, he's there, but we hardly ever hear from him or see him.
Yes, and I don't think that he was so much absent as he was quiet.
Yeah.
He was definitely there, and from what and close members of the Carpenters camp, I guess you would say, have told me, he was definitely a rock solid force in Karen's life, and she could totally count on him. And he was very silent. And you'll see interviews with Agnes and Harold, and he'll start to answer things, and usually he's interrupted by Agnes, and she finishes whatever thought he might have been starting. So he tried to interject every once in a while or have an opinion, and was usually shot down.
I was pretty shocked to learn when I read your book, Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter, that they lived at home. Richard and Karen Carpenter lived at home until they were in their late 20s.
That's correct. They, in the early 1970s, shortly after their first number one, which was Close to You, they left the south side of Downey. They bought a new house on the north side of town in Downey. That probably would have been a good time for them to get their own places, but they stayed there with their parents because they were on the road so much, and they really didn't have that much time to devote to finding their own places at that point. There was an apartment that the two of them rented for a short period of time, and Karen wasn't too happy with that because Richard expected her to do all the things that his mother had done as far as washing the clothes and cooking the meals and that sort of thing, and she wasn't too big on that.
But you're saying that even when Karen and Richard left home briefly, they lived together. They continued to live together.
They did continue to live together, yes. And like I said, that didn't work out real well. They moved back in with the parents. And finally, around 1974, they bought a house for their parents a couple of miles away, still in Downey. And turns out that the parents, I would imagine Agnes, didn't really care for the other house. She wanted to stay in the original house that they had bought. So Karen and Richard moved together into this new home a couple of miles away. And like I said, they still live together in this home as well. And part of it was that, part of the excuse that I've heard is that Karen was a young lady. She was a superstar, and Richard could be there to protect her. And but I think the real thing is that they were just inseparable. They were a team in every sort of way, and they were constantly planning in music what was next, and it was an around-the-clock business for them. There was never really any downtime, especially in 73, 74, around this time.
We've only just begun to live, white lace and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way.
talking with Randy Schmidt, and his new book is called Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. Richard and Karen's relationship, well, it might not have been sexual, but it certainly has an incestuous feeling to it.
There were hints of that along the way, and there was one situation where they were doing a phone interview with a DJ out of Toronto. And halfway through the interview, he said, you know, we figured this out. You know, Karen's singing these songs to you. This is about incest. And Richard tried to explain, you know, she's the sister, and I happen to do the arrangements and this sort of thing. Instead of what he said later on he would have liked to have done is just slam the phone down. But, I mean, it was an odd relationship, but they were extremely close.
I guess that image wasn't helped much by them standing, you know, center stage facing each other, singing We've Only Just Begun and staring.
Singing love songs, sure, sure.
It seems to me that their real talent lay in recording, and that their live performances, maybe not so much.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard is that they wouldn't have made a single cent from any of their concerts each year until they had completed something like 150 concerts. Then they would start profiting from those. So looking back, it would have made more sense to do more albums, less touring, and the less touring would have, of course, given them some more free time to spend on relationships, for them to get out on their own and meet other people and to develop friendships and that sort of thing. But they toured during the biggest part of their heyday, upwards of 200 shows a year, and recorded an album pretty much every year. But yeah, looking back, we would have had a lot more recorded output, and they probably would have remained a little more sane over the years if they had had a chance to recover and vacation and all those things that they never took the time to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the music. Karen Carpenter had a remarkable voice. There's a point in her life where she suddenly discovered that she had this beautiful voice.
She, other than dance and tap and ballet and that sort of thing, she hadn't been involved too much in music other than listening. Her and Richard had been, they had been fans of their dad's record collection. He had this collection of old 78s that they would play and swing. They would play it and they would swing in the basement. The dad had screwed some swings into the rafters, and for hours on end, they would listen to his old 78s, and so that was kind of the basis of her music. At that point, she played the flute at one point in elementary school, and the accordion, and none of those ever took. She wasn't really that set on any of them. When she entered Downey High School after they moved to California in 1963, when she entered Downey High School, she became interested in the drums. And that became her primary instrument. She started off on the Glockenspiel, and very quickly moved to the tenor drum, and the voice just kind of happened. It was Richard had done some what he considered top 40 material. He was writing some songs and things, and he gave them to her to sing, whether it be for demo purposes or for audition purposes, and for a while, some of the sounds that were very common for a girl of that age, of 13 or 14, she sang in kind of a lighter, high head tone, or that higher falsetto register. And then around the age of 16, something happened, and that low register, that big booming low register, showed its face. And I think it was just something magical.
Are we really happy? This lonely game we play, looking for the right words to say, searching but not finding, understanding anyway, we're lost in this masquerade. To say we're just too far away from being close together from the start. to talk it over, but the words got in the way. We're lost inside this lonely game we play. Thoughts of leaving disappear each time I see your eyes. And no matter how understand the reason why we carry on this way, we're lost in this masquerade.
I think one of the saddest parts of the story of Karen Carpenter is her aborted solo album.
1979 found Richard entering the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas for an addiction to Quaaludes. And although it would have been probably a pretty good time for Karen to address some of her issues with the eating disorder, she wasn't there mentally. She wasn't ready to admit it, and she certainly wasn't ready to take time off and devote it to something in that way. So she had toyed with the idea of a solo album off and on through the years, and I think really she secretly wanted some recognition as a solo artist. You know, there were so many other great singers at that time that were known for their name, and she was known as the lead singer of the Carpenters. And they were always up for duo, you know, outstanding performance by a duo or group when it came time for Grammys. And she never really got the recognition as a solo singer that she deserved. And so she saw this as a chance to work with other producers. I think it scared her, definitely. She had only known, you know, one record company, one producer slash brother. And it was definitely going to be something out of her comfort zone. But she was put in touch with Phil Ramone, who at that point had produced a lot of hits for Billy Joel and Paul Simon. And so he was pretty hot at that time as far as his production. She wanted Richard's approval, even though he was incapacitated musically, professionally. She wanted his approval before she went on with it. And kind of on the eve of her departure for New York to go and do this project, she called and said, you know, I have to know that you're okay with me doing this and that you're behind me. And she was upset, and he, you know, just to kind of pacify her, said, you know, it's fine, go and do it, I'm behind you, just please don't do disco. And so fast forward a couple of days, she's in the initial meetings with Phil Ramone, and he says, so Karen, what would you like to do? What are you interested in? What kind of music? And she said, well, I really love Donna Summer. And she said, her song, you know, her song Hot Stuff is one of my favorite songs, and it was a new single at that time. And so I don't know if it was an intentional going against brother kind of thing, or if she just, if she intentionally, you know, she really just liked it. But that was the last thing he expected to hear from her. And so they started looking for material, and it was definitely sort of right field from anything Carpenters. And that was good, though. He didn't want to reproduce the same sound that they had with Close to You and We've Only Just Begun. That was never the intention. But I think most of all, this project, whether it would have succeeded commercially or not, I think that it would have done so much for Karen to be able to know that the product was out there and to know that it was her brainchild and kind of her baby. She picked the music. She was 100% involved, start to finish. All of the background vocals and everything were overdubbed by her, and it was 100% Karen. I think that's what was so important about it. It was a chance for her to express herself as an individual, as a singer, as an artist.
Yeah.
Karen had taken quite a bit of time to do this. This was recorded off and on over a year because Karen was bicoastal at the time. She was living, you know, in L.A. part of the time, and she was living with Phil and his wife Karen Ramon part of the time in New York. And so it was taking quite a bit of time, and it took quite a bit more money than a usual album would take. In addition to the $100,000 that A&M put forward, as they would do for most of their albums, she ended up spending $400,000 of her own on this as well. So it was a very expensive project. And so it came time for the playback in Los Angeles. And this was for Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, the head of A&M Records. And Karen wanted Richard present for the playbacks. And so those present were Richard, Herb, Jerry, and Phil Ramone, along with Karen. And as they sat there, song after song after song, there were no responses. And Phil got a little antsy and was biting his nails, and he could tell that Karen was definitely uptight, and this was not what she had expected, because she was waiting to be congratulated or celebrated after each of the songs she'd worked so hard on. And the silence was deafening. Those are Phil's words, but the silence was deafening. And not just, you know, we need to go back and redo this, or why don't you try doing a song of this genre, or not just suggestions for making it better, but the album was deemed unreleasable. And they've said since that they wanted to protect Karen by doing that, by, you know, that the critics, there wasn't a hit single on the album. And they were protecting Karen by somehow, you know, telling her this isn't releasable as is. And I think the thing is if it had been given that chance to be heard, she could have taken the criticisms. She could have taken the critics. She could have taken poor reviews long before she could have taken that kind of feedback from the people that she loved and trusted the most. And I think what really happened is Richard was ready to work again, and A&M knew that if they wanted to protect the duo, I mean, there was that potential that Karen could have become a solo artist. Now, did she want to leave Richard behind? I don't think so. I think that she wanted to go off and do her own thing and then come back and maybe record a Carpenters album and then maybe do another solo album, but there was never that intention with her that I'm going to leave Richard and do my own thing forever. But I think the family saw potential for her to go off and do her own thing, and then, you know, what's Richard left to do?
But in fact, as had happened with some other 70s artists like John Denver, who had been really up at the top in 1973, 74, you know, by 1979 and 80, the music business had moved beyond them, and they weren't the stars they once were and never would be again.
Well, that was really tough for Karen and Richard. They were so concerned with having the next hit record and keeping everything, you know, as good as the last or even better. And that's just not something that can even be expected. And I mean, it's one of those hindsight things. Looking back, I mean, they could have recorded some great albums of standards or, you know, show tunes, whatever it might have been. Would it have been commercially successful and been on the top 10? Probably not. But would it have been some great material and, you know, in the long run, a great part of their legacy? Sure. But they were so concerned with having that next hit and finding out what would sell and, you know, watching the charts week after week after week and tracking all of those things. It was really, really a business for them, as artistic as they were. That's what's so funny. They were so artistic and so amazing with the impeccable, you know, with those impeccable arrangements, and everything was done so precisely and beautifully. But then the business side was the next part. You know, how's it selling? Where is it working? What's not working here? What's our next song? It was really a business.
Fabulous book. It's called Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter, and the author, our guest today, Randy Schmidt. Randy, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. I enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Randy Schmidt for being my guest this week. His book is called Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.